So is there anything you can't do?
Oh, so much, so much.
Hello, I'm Jessica Kadzo-Collins, and this is the Inside the Jewel Vault podcast. Each episode, I ask my guests to choose the 6 gems or jewels they would put into their fantasy jewel vault. I hope you enjoy listening. We recorded this episode remotely. My guest inside the vault today is the multi-talented mantor, Darren Sherwood, whose numerous digital skills blend seamlessly with his traditional craftsmanship. He's the first and only goldsmith in his family, and Darren took his first steps into the craft on a foundation course at St. Martin's and then honed his skills in the greatest workshops in London, from Grant MacDonald to Graff, before setting up on his own. On the way, he's acquired more skills and accomplishments than most diamond mantors ever learn in one entire career. Welcome, Darren. I can't wait to see what you've got for us inside your jewel vault.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Darren, so is there anything you can't do?
Oh, so much, so much. still got loads more to learn.
Well, there can't be too many. So how have you been able to master so many different disciplines?
I wouldn't say master. I would say more proficient than most. Yeah, it's just down to I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so I continuously put myself down until I get something that I'm happy with, really. Which you know, in the trade, I was taught early on that you're only as good as your last job, so you kind of always aim for that, aim for perfection, whether or not you ever achieve it, I don't know.
And so, are you from a very creative background? Is your family this group of talented geniuses like you?
Artistically, no. No, I don't think. Because we're from, you know, my family originates from Trinidad and Tobago. So, you know, we grew up there. I spent my primary school years in Trinidad. So there was no such thing as sport or art in Trinidad because they are so, they push book work. And analytical skills more than anything, which is kind of strange for an island that created carnival. You know, when I was growing up, there was very, very little art. We weren't allowed really by the schools to do art, or if it was very, you know, your teacher isn't in to teach you something, so go and do some art. You know, it was kind of like a substitute class, but. You know, we grew up, my parents used to be involved in carnival, so we were always around, like, the big mass bands making huge carnival costumes and, you know, growing up witnessing people like McFarlane or Peter Minchell. He organises the openings for the Olympic Games, I think, three times now, and he's, you know, I grew up with him designing costumes in Trinidad, so these are the things that kind of got me when I was really young into the whole creative thing and wanting to get into art. But to get into jewellery, I had no idea I wanted to get into jewellery, to be honest.
So your parents and teachers were expecting you to follow a conventional academic path. So how did you find yourself on that foundation course at St. Martin's that's led onto this roll call of the top workshops in the jewellery industry?
Well, we came back to England in 1994. And my sister was doing her O-levels in Trinidad, so she stayed there until she was about 16. When she came back, I moved into the same school she did, and she went into medicine, and now is she went into become a doctor and a GP, and obviously I went, I don't want to do anything like that, I'm going into art. So you can imagine how that went down. But, you know, I did my A-levels in art, went for the interview at St. Martin's, and they liked my work, and I got in for their foundation course, which was absolutely amazing. Great experience, met some of my best friends and best contacts ever in St. Martin's. It was a great place. It's a great course because you could trial everything. So from photography to typography, sculpture, product design, everything. So I specialized in jewelry, product design and sculpture because I love metal. I love shiny things. So I thought, oh, I'll go into sculpture and make metal sculptures, or I'll make metal products. Like, jewelry was just a tool to get into either sculpture or product design. And then I realized I was way wrong for sculpture. Like, sculptor and fine artist mentality is completely polar opposite to mine. I am, you know, one of the tutors just turned around and said, I'm far too technical for sculpture. I don't have that freedom that sculptors have. And I was like, yeah, you're pretty much right, actually. I completely and utterly agree. I specialize in jewelry because I thought I could still release my creativity, but on a very OCD technical level, really.
Well, sure. So, Darren, you've had a stellar pathway. You've worked with some of the greatest brands and names in jewellery, from Graff to Cartier, Stephen Webster, Garrard, Mikimoto, Grant McDonald. You must have had some amazing gems and jewels pass through your hands, quite literally. So what was your personal criteria for just choosing 6 pieces to put inside your jewel vault for us?
I've been very lucky to be around, or, you know, witness and handle some of these incredible jewels pretty much from when I started in the industry. But I think the 6 were probably not the most beautiful or amazing pieces I've worked on, but they were all, you know, big steps for me personally. You know, whether it be a massive learning curve, an absolute nightmare of a job, or just me trying new things and seeing how they'll turn out, which pushed me into a different direction in my career or you know, personal skill set. So I have worked on things that are just astronomically expensive but I don't think, you know, they were beautiful, but not one of my memorable pieces.
So let's have a look then at what you've got for us inside the jewel vault. Tell us, what's the first piece in here?
The first piece would be the silver and wooden clock that I designed back in the second year in college, actually. Because of my work that I was producing in the first year of my BA course, I was awarded a bursary from the Worshipful Company of Goldsmiths. So I came up with this design, submitted it to them, they approved it, and I handmade that because, you know, back then I wanted to get in silversmithing more than anything. So obviously, as you could tell from the design, I very much like Star Wars and anything sci-fi.
So true. The shape and the shiny body is very futuristic. It's an amazing shape for a clock. It's like a piece of sculpture, with a long silver body and this round clock face set into the top, and with lots of lovely, rich wooden inlay. It is pretty Star Warsy. Is that where you got your idea?
Yeah, it was based off one of the newer designs, or the concept designs for one of the ships in Star Wars Episode 1, which was out at the time I made this. Because my family in Trinidad also own, they run a timber yard and tropical woods supplier, I've always grown up around beautiful tropical woods. So I wanted to get that kind of combination between silver and tropical wood. And obviously I picked a god-awful shape and design where, you know, the typical Brian and Bob May thing as tutors was like, oh yeah, that would be amazing, it'd be fantastic. This is an absolute nightmare of a job.
I know. I'm just looking at all of these curves. It's really not an easy thing. And then inset into this very complex 3D arrow, which also flares and narrows at the waist, are these pieces of wood, which also had to be carved, I imagine.
Yes, they were. I literally went to a tropical timber yard, bought a massive lump of padauk, which is beautiful orange wood, and I carved the whole thing up and sculpted it to match the silver piece. But the interesting thing with this was that I had to, you know, to make that clock mechanism fit and make the whole body to hold it in place and everything, and to make everything symmetrical in metal and in wood was, that was such a nice learning curve for me. You know, I'd love to make another thing like it. I just haven't had the time as yet. I've got plans though, maybe.
So it's interesting now, primarily, you're a diamond mounter, but your early experience was really all about using silver, and your love of form must have stayed with you to inspire your amazing computer design skills. You could have followed any one of these career paths. So what was your first job after college?
I went back to my old school as an art technician, and I was losing the will to live, really, because it was just soul-destroying more than anything. And then I got a letter from Brian Hill saying, you know, this gentleman's looking for a new diamond mounter to help him out, or a new trainee. So I went there for the job interview at Mark Griffin's in Griffin of London, based on South Moulton Street. And I sat there, and it was literally something to make a four-claw collet in 9-carat yellow gold. And this, I got there early. So the day was starting at 9. I got there about 8, I think. And I left around 7:30 in the evening. And I literally had one last solder on the bottom bezel, because it was a little bit high on one claw. So he said, just heat it up gently and press it down slightly. And, you know, when the solder melts, it will, you know, push that bottom bezel level. So there I was heating it up gently. You know, this is after, it's a 12-hour day almost. And squeezing it down, and then obviously overheated it. My tweezers snapped shut. There was nothing left of this collet anyway. Like, you couldn't find a claw, piece of metal, nothing. It's gone.
Oh, my God, Darren. Oh, I'm cringing. Oh, I really feel that. That's an interview nightmare. Oh.
So some miraculous way he goes, you know what? I've seen how you work, and I'd like to give you a try. So you come in for a trial for 3 months and see how you get on, see if it's for you, if you like it or not, and then we can go from there. And I was with him for 6 years. It was brilliant. We just... he's such a good guy. He was very patient with me, because I was breakdancing at the time still, so I used to roll in completely red eye because I was out wherever in London breakdancing the night before.
So talk us through the next piece in your vault.
The gauge style ring, yes. That one was... oh, that was fun.
So this is a design that the jeweller Elizabeth Gage made incredibly fashionable in the 80s and 90s. Yellow, gold and big and bold, with decorations surrounding a brightly coloured gemstone. It's quite ornate.
These rings are pretty much very antique styled, with loads of twisted wire that are mirrored. So you have to have the twists, the opposites, and... loads of beads and loads of settings all over it. And the thing that's really annoying with this job, well, one, you have to turn up a wide flat band first, which is your base band that everything else slides onto or pins into. So to get something completely symmetrical on that is annoying as it is, you know. But the worst part is the twisted wires, because, you know, soldering a twisted wire, If the twisted wire has to finish at 0.8 mil wide, that means each wire in it has to be 0.4. And then to solder that without melting them, and to get them to meet at the back so the twist continues, it was just absolute hell.
Yeah, no, Darren, it's making me feel upset just listening to that.
yeah, it was just, but, you know, it was an amazing learning curve, because...
it's a beautiful ring.
You know... yeah, they're beautiful things, and I just hope I never have to make one ever again. But you know, they're lovely things, and they're very effective when they're finished. You know, they do look really nice. But like I say, it was an absolute headache.
So I'm presuming this is in the vault because of the fact that it was a big learning curve. Is that right?
Yeah, it was an absolute huge learning curve, because I have this, I suppose, you know, I was probably 25 when I made that, maybe a bit younger, actually. And I was still very much, I need to get everything done quickly. These rings slow you right down. You can't rush them, because if you do, you know, if you melt something like that twisted band, you're going to lose days. you know, it's not a case of it was just, oh, just pull it off and do something else. You will lose days on a job, and as well as wasting a lot of metal. And if you go too far on it, then you have to scrap the whole thing and start again. So they kind of, they're really good jobs to force you to take your time. And yeah, and just make you realize you're not as good as you think you are, because they, you know, that is your perfect, you're only as good as your last soldering, really.
So it gives you respect for the metal and for the technique.
I hope this style comes back, or more people get interested into it, because this teaches a lot of people a lot of things, a lot of skill sets. You know, you can't do that in CAD, that ring. There's no way.
Really?
No.
There's no shortcut, and you just have to learn how to do it. You have to learn the technique. You have to have this mathematical precision.
Yeah, which is an absolute nightmare. But yeah.
So these sorts of eye-opening experiences must have, they didn't daunt your determination to succeed in this industry at all?
No, I'm not really one to give up on things. You know, I keep it going until I'm happy, really, and I'm very, really happy. So, you know, I just keep battling on until I'm somewhere where I'd like to be. You know, things like jobs like these only make you better. So no, things like that wouldn't daunt me out, you know.
So after Mark, where did you go next?
After I left Mark, I went to Graf Diamonds.
Wow.
International.
And how did that role come about? That must have been the most amazing experience.
Yeah, well, I remember that a couple of friends from Cartier told me that they're looking for new mounters. You should go and check them out. And I went, who the hell are Graf? I don't know who you are. But all right, I didn't have a clue. And I applied for them, and I remember going into the interview with Raymond Graf, and he was like, can you make this? I went, yeah, well, I could do that. Can you make this? Like, yeah, I could do that. I says, okay. And then it was kind of a really simple interview, just wanted to see my face. And then he called back, and I remember going in for the second interview, and the security guard just went to me and said, when are you starting then? I went, well, I don't know. I didn't even get a job prospect yet. I didn't get told anything. And then Raymond called me in, and he goes, yeah, so when would you like to start? I was like, oh, I don't know, a month? Completely caught me off guard. I did not have a clue if I was going to get the job. But, you know, it was a massive eye-opener, Graf, because it was just really, you see how the other half, not even the other half, the other 5% live, or 3% live. It's just
0.01%.
Yeah. You know, I got to work on the most expensive brooch in the world, the most expensive watch in the world, this £89 million necklace, which is just mind-blowing.
Wow. And is this the piece in your vault? So tell us about piece three.
This piece number three, it was beautiful... it was a ruby and diamond necklace that I made. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it more than anything. And it was just a really pretty design, I thought. I really enjoyed it. And then the snap had to go over this, I say, this tiny 1.5-carat ruby at the back, or sapphire at the back, sorry. Ruby at the back, which for Graf standard today is kind of small. But, you know, it was just a really nice piece. And I got to see it from start to finish, as well as you know, see the stock photos of it as it was being worn and modeled, which was really nice. But there's so many things that could go terribly wrong in this job that you can't really notice, because it's a double row of diamonds. So you've got round diamonds up the top, set like a line bracelet, and then the bottom is ruby and diamonds, like alternating, going up it in different shapes, varying from hearts to emerald cuts all the way up, and pear shapes in diamonds and rounds. So the problem you have with that is when you put the centerpiece on, when that centerpiece weight pulls on that necklace, if they pull too far apart, or if one joint is too tight in comparison to the others, the whole thing is unsymmetrical.
Well, looking at the model shot you've given me, it's the sexiest necklace I think I've ever seen in my whole life. It just oozes glamour and excitement. And the rubies and diamonds, well, the rubies look like droplets of blood, and it's quite long, it's flowing down to the cleavage. It just looks effortless. But when you start to describe the sort of technical nightmare of assembling each of these articulated collets, every one of them has to be a different size to fit that particular stone, it does make you see it in a whole fresh light, I must say. It's stunning. How many hours did it take to make?
Oh, gosh. That was... Oh, God. I think that was about a 3-week job, I think.
Well, Graff's gems and jewellery, a whole different level of quality and perfection. Quite extraordinary, and you're so lucky to have experienced this world.
Yeah, it was it was a lot of fun. You know, that's the good thing with Graff. You were able to experience things that you just wouldn't see anywhere else in the world. And they are stunning, stunning diamonds, stunning stones. They really are probably the best in the world for what they do. When it comes to I remember seeing an emerald necklace there, and the size of the Colombian emeralds were just, you know, you could just buy a small country with these stones, I reckon. They were just so expensive. Beautiful, beautiful things.
So why is this necklace, out of all the amazing things that you've made and you've just mentioned, why is this necklace in your vault? Why is it in your fantasy vault?
I think it was, one, because I quite like rubies. And this was one of the first necklaces I made.
So talk us through piece 4 in your fantasy vault.
Ah, the diamond cuff.
Is this also a Bane? Is this a Graff piece?
This is a Graff piece. Uh-huh. So this was an absolute nightmare. But it's like a huge cuff, probably about maybe 6 inches long or high, I would say. So it goes up the arm. And it was made up of little separate sections. So in theory, it looks like a fan, a symmetrical fan. So you've got one center open piece with diamonds down the middle of each. And they're sprung. It springs open on two parts. So it goes over the wrist and clicks down. So the challenges included were from the design. The first issue I got was, when you translate the design to a physical piece, the curve doesn't work. So if the curve doesn't work, then that means the rest of your layout doesn't work. So for me to do something on a super accurate program, because most of this was on computer with little handmade bits in between, but so I catted the three sections on that curve as best as I could, but when you wrapped it around a wrist, it just all went out of whack. And then, you know, you've got to think that so as the diamonds are tapering down from the top of the center section, that top diamond, the top round one, is 9 carats.
What?
Yeah.
So it's a vast piece of jewellery.
Yeah, the so-called pavé they've got on it, it's 47 carats of pavé.
These are mind-blowing.
So you can kind of understand the size of this thing. It was absolutely huge. But the interesting thing...
How much was it worth?
I have absolutely no idea.
So this wasn't actually a bespoke piece made to fit a person's wrist. This was made on spec.
As you do. But, you know, it was really nice when it was finished. It looked beautiful when it was polished, finished and everything. It looked really nice because all the stones in the middle looked like they were floating, you know, because they're all on one bar going through them, so you couldn't really see the bar and they weren't touching the ends. It was a nightmare of a job, and I'm kind of glad I never have to see one again. But since then, I have made other cuffs for other companies, so this thing has put me in much better stead than most mounters, because to make cuffs this size, not many people have.
Darren, it's kind of like summiting Everest and then only in your career, and then after that you've just summited, I don't know, Ben Nevis.
Yeah, learning curve and the share amount of swearing that was involved in making it. I think that was where I was, yeah.
Tell us about piece 5, which is a Cocker Spaniel. And this is adorable.
Yes, this was a Cocker Spaniel for Fabergé. It's to go inside one of their little eggs. So, as you know, when you open up a Fabergé egg, you've got a surprise in it. So this was one of them. And they phoned me up, said, can you do this? I went, maybe. Don't know. Never tried it. Who sculpts a dog? So I started off, the way I started off, I found this really horrible, like, disgustingly scary little ceramic thing of a dog in a charity shop. It was horrible. It was really horrible. It looked like nothing like a dog, but it kind of had the shape. So I thought, oh, I'll take some photos of that. And I kind of had that on my screen and then pushed and pulled. So this is when I started using ZBrush.
So ZBrush, that's a seriously advanced 3D sculpting software that you use, yeah?
I kind of learned how to use ZBrush by modeling this dog and finding out all the new techniques and all this. And I did this in a weekend.
Wow.
Started on Friday night and, yeah, finished Sunday.
So instead of using wax and the traditional approach by carving the dog, you did it on a 3D modelling program. So what's the advantage of doing it on computer?
The good thing with doing things on computer, I can size it to whatever size I want. So I've printed this out on my 3D printer to about 6 inches high and then down to a centimetre high. So... And it still holds all its detail.
Yeah,
so
it's stunning. That's piece 5 in your vault. And why have you put that in? How big was it finished?
If I remember correctly, it was tiny. It was something like 1.5 centimetres.
Oh, mini.
Yeah, he was tiny. And he had diamond eyes and everything. So
he's a super cute spaniel with these long floppy ears and curly hair. He's got his mouth open, looks like he's about to cover you with friendly licks. The level of detail is incredible. I can even see tiny claws on his feet.
Yeah, and it was really ridiculous, actually. This is how bad of how much I went into this. I cut off his jaw and sculpted the inside of his mouth and all his gums and everything and put it back in.
Good heavens.
Completely, completely pointless and over-engineered, but that's kind of what I do.
So. The level of detail is mind-blowing.
But I think this got me into learning a different program and a different way of doing CAD. It taught me a lot in sculpting and what is actually possible. And it kind of forced me to do things a different way, because there is no way you could do this in Rhino or Matrix. It's too sculptural. And you couldn't add the textures and all that.
Oh, sure. I can see why it's in your fantasy vault. It's yet another amazing milestone along your journey in jewellery. So we've got 5 pieces in your vault now. What's the 6th item you've got for us and why?
These were really strange earrings I did for a workshop based in London. They were really creepy hands. that an amethyst, so it was both sides, the hands are posed in different poses or different positions, and you had an amethyst, one on the top and one on the bottom on either side of the ear. So, but the thing that got me, this isn't like in here, because my whole point of going into ZBrush initially was to learn how to do sculptures, you know, back to my thinking that I could be a sculptor one day, whatever. Yeah, that. And then I thought, well, I'll get this and I'll just sculpt, you know, Batman or something and make a cool model and I'll paint it and it'll all be amazing. I realized I really cannot sculpt people, and anatomy is a whole different new skill. I was like, right, so I know nothing. So when I tried to do my first hand that I did, you know, you do the usual thing, you get a lump, and you try to pull out fingers, and then it went terribly wrong. It looked like something out of a horror film, really. So yeah, didn't do that one. So looked at a few more tutorials, and then it went back into anatomy, which has always fascinated me since I was young as well. And most of the sculptors will tell you, you build your skeleton, then you build the muscle groups, and then you go from there. And that's what I did. I studied all my anatomy books and got all the muscle groups sorted. But what was really good with this was that when I sculpted the hand, which was just a basic hand in an upright position, I then put a skeleton inside of it, which is called rigging. You make a hand, then you put a skeleton in it, then you compose it, and then all your detail that you've put on that initial hand follows. So it was like a massive, massive step forward for me in the CAD side of things. Yeah, I learned a load, loads and loads and loads with that. That, and they were extremely creepy. So
this was a one-off piece of for a client, was it? And it was just a pair of earrings.
Yeah.
And you went to this level of study and understanding and preparation to produce this pair of hands. It's astonishing, Darren.
Yeah, a bit overkill, but yeah.
And have you ever been asked to do anything quite like this again?
No, I haven't.
Because they are beautiful. The hands are, you know, the finished product, stunning.
I had to put little diamond rings on them, and then they were a little, they were wearing gold bracelets as well. So that bit was handmade at the end. But
And so were they the client's hands, or were they just anybody's hands, a pair of generic hands?
No, they're just any hands that I sculpted. You know, a 2D sketch of a drawer of a hand in the kind of position that they want. And then you've got to turn a 3D hand into that pose, which is really interesting because, and also the hand that's slightly open, so it looks like it's holding something, the amethyst had to fit inside that hand with the collet. So I kind of had to make them in a way that I kind of sculpted the stone and the bezel and the collet to fit inside that hand.
Well, I have been told by sculptors that hands are that's a level of mastery, that once you can sculpt hands, then you can do pretty much anything. But they're very difficult.
I still got to work up the rest of the body. I haven't done the forearm yet.
So you've set up your own business now, of course, haven't you? Plus it's amazing you've had time to get married and start a family. You know, you work round the clock. How involved are you with the children, or have they had to get involved with you and your work so that they see you? Have you got them on the payroll yet?
Oh gosh, yeah. My little demon children. So now we have a new shop, Sherwood Jewellery, based in Purley. And my wife and I, we renovated the whole place on our own over lockdown. And we were juggling between one of us is here, one of us is at home with the kids. I was still working anyway because I've never stopped, you know, doing CAD work for people, either in England or overseas. So it's kind of always working, always doing something. And, you know, my wife, she's absolutely amazing. She's, you know, incredible at multitasking, whereas I pretty much remember to blink and breathe at the same time. We've turned one of the rooms into a room for the kids. Not that it keeps them inside there when they're in here. So if you ever come over to the shop, you'll probably, if they're here, you will definitely hear them. And if they're not, you will definitely see the remnants of them with little handprints all over the walls everywhere. Little demons. But yes, we got four little ones from 1.5 up to 6.
Wow. So I can't believe that. This is such a busy man. And so with your wife being married to a jeweler of your incredible talent, what's her wedding and engagement ring like? I'm expecting something very intricate and amazing.
Yeah, well, let's see. I made her engagement ring 3 years after we were married.
Under duress?
Kind of. You know, it was that literally the only thing that made me make it was, where's her engagement ring? You're a jeweler. I was like, I got the diamond. All right. One step at a time. I bought the bloody stone. What more do you want? So yeah, that was sitting there doing nothing for quite some time. Yeah, but you know, it's a very nice, I can't even remember how big the thing was now. Anyway, it was like a double halo I think it's an Ashokat center with split shank and set on all sides. So it was pretty cool.
And so overall, I mean, you know, now you're running a shop. Now you've had a whole career. How many years in jewelry now?
It would be 22 years in total. I've started. So, yeah.
And you've got many more years ahead of you, obviously. So what do you think is so special about jewelry that you've devoted these hours and nights, days and nights?
It's essential. People love jewelry. Even if you don't like jewelry, you still have jewelry. You know, whether it's a beaded necklace or a lace bracelet or something, it still classifies as jewelry. And, you know, it's seen as like portable money. You know, you got people like Morgan Freeman rocking his giant earrings, just in case he dies anywhere. He has money to bury him, you know.
Like a pirate.
Like a pirate. Exactly. But I think, you know, jewelry is under... people don't really give it the kind of respect it's due, because you got to think, every generation, as far back as you can go, like the Babylonians were making jewelry. I think people are getting a bit too used to the run-of-the-mill jewelry, and they're forgetting that jewelry is really not for you. It's who you're going to give it to when you're gone. You're making heirlooms for other people. And I like the idea that pieces that I make can last hundreds and hundreds of years, and will hopefully still be cherished by the same family.
Oh, well, that's really well put, Darren. Well, let's review your vault. We have six pieces, very different pieces from your first foray of silversmithing at college, making this incredibly sculptural clock from Caribbean wood and silver, to the surprisingly difficult gauge style ring, the spectacular pieces you made at Graff, the diamond cuff and the ruby necklace, the nano spaniel you made for the Fabergé Exa Prize, and the amazing hand earrings. Six incredible pieces, very, very technically challenging. If you were about to lose all of those pieces apart from one, which you could keep safe forever, which one piece would it be and why?
Well, value-wise, it'd be that cuff, but... Don't know about keeping it safe forever. It might be in bits. I think the spaniel. That was my... Yeah, it was the most fun for me. I enjoyed that one. And, you know, I got to look at a really cute dog to sculpt it, so it wasn't too bad. You know...
Okay, well, you can keep that, but you'd probably need a loop to have a look at all your amazing work.
Yeah.
To enjoy the miniature detail. Well, thank you so much for taking us inside your jewel vault, Darren. It's been wonderful exploring your very inspiring, very diverse and very technically challenging pieces. So thank you so much, Darren Sherwood, for sharing your life and work with us in your fantasy vault.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we did recording it. You can find images of all the wonderful jewels we've been talking about, along with lots more information, at our website. Just go to vipjewelvault.com/podcast. And I want to hear from you. Tell me, what special pieces would you put into your fantasy jewel vault and why? Every so often I'll be collating your stories into a podcast of their own, so please get in touch and of course rate, review and subscribe so we can keep these conversations as meaningful and joyous as we can. Thank you.